The Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Colleagues, welcome to this week's meeting. It is a bit busy. Just a couple of minor changes on the schedule that we have. HB 2183 for the public, that's a work session. We're going to carry over to next week. I'd asked some feedback from the chair of the other Veterans Committee, and he's been out sick for a week, if you don't know. He will be here today, and then we'll follow up on that. So House Bill 2183's work session will be carried over to next week. Other than that, we're going to go pretty much down the schedule. We have some guests from the other chamber here, but before we do that, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I always like reading the book from the book, When Janie Comes Marching Home. It's Portraits of Women Combat Veterans. And this particular one is from Senior Master Sergeant Pamela Hadsall, who's in the, in the U.S. Air Force. My dad spent several years in the Marine Corps many years ago. When I called him and said, hey, I'm deploying, he said, Pam, you can retire. Just retire now. You move down here. You can come work for me, and I don't want you to go over there. He was getting really angry at me, and I said, Dad, I love you, but you just need to support me. You need to support my decision. He hates the war, hated it from day one, but I had to tell him, don't get mad at me. It's my job. It's what I do. I am out there helping to keep us free. So if you just look at it that way, that's going to help me get through my deployment. I'm a registered Republican. He's a registered Democrat. So we're just opposite ends. But he just didn't want to lose his daughter. My sister called me up the day before I left and was bawling her eyes out and saying, what if I never see you again? How am I going to live without you? I'm like, Bonnie, I'm not dead. I'm not going over there and intentionally getting myself shot. But I know the risk. I knew the risk before I went over there, and I'm still okay to do that. My husband knew the risk and still deployed because we love the Air Force, and we love our country, and we love what we do, so we went. Without hesitation, we went, and we would go again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And with those inspiring comments, it's appropriate to go to the concurrent resolutions. If Representative Bentz wants to come forward, Council, you want to tee us up for number 11, please?
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, HCR 11 honors Brigadier General Julie Bentz on being the first female Brigadier General of the Oregon Army National Guard.
Are you related?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair.
You're related?
Well, it depends on if that's good or bad in front of this committee.
It's good in this committee.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cliff Bentz, District 60, here in support of HCR 11, which honors my first cousin, Julie A. Bentz, on being the first female Brigadier General of the Oregon Army National Guard. Members of the committee, I would just say that since I have known Julie, General Bentz, now since she was three, it's pretty amazing that she would end up going through Oregon State University, getting her commission, moving on to, actually she had a difficult choice. She had to choose becoming a Catholic nun and spent 3 years in Africa, actually, and then decided to come back and get her degree in nuclear engineering, her PhD in nuclear engineering, and then move into the White House, where she has been in the Pentagon for the past 12 or 15 years. She currently sits on the National Security Council. Her former boss was just appointed to the head of the CIA. After I carried this bill on the floor of the House, I went out to dinner with Julie and her family out at Staten, and she was here because there was a process honoring General Rees. She had come here for that. And I asked her the difference between the Bush and the Obama administrations. And the story was really extraordinarily interesting. I'll share it with you very briefly. And I said, what is the difference? And she said, well, in the Bush administration, President Bush hired folks that he knew extraordinarily well and had kind of tight-knit group. She said, President Obama hires people who think differently and share with him different takes on different challenging situations. And I said, well, which is better? She goes, well, for a member of staff, which she is, she's there to provide the consistency. She said President Bush's approach is better because it's more predictable. She said President Obama's approach is more likely to come up with innovative and interesting ideas, but less predictable. It was a hugely interesting comment on the challenges faced by people at the very top of trying to keep us safe. She very much enjoys what she does. She's very, very good at it. I guess it's kind of hard for her to take credit for us not having been attacked with a nuclear device in the past few years that she's been there. She certainly doesn't attempt to do that. And in fact, her job is to figure out what to do in case that horrible and terrible event should happen. We are extremely fortunate to have someone of that quality from Oregon in Washington helping protect us. And I think this measure does a little to reflect upon that good fortune, and I would ask for your support.
Thank you very much. I don't recall Julie, but I was at Oregon State in the ROTC program when she was there. I was commissioned 2 years before she was, but that would have meant she was still in the program. And ironically enough, General Caldwell knows this, my former boss, which was General Barlow, studied in Sheridan to become a priest. And he was one step short of becoming a priest and instead became a combat pilot in Vietnam.
Oh, my God.
And later the adjutant general of the state of Washington, who I work for. So it is a strange world. None to priest, so on and so forth like that. And we definitely appreciate, you know, her service to the nation. Madam Vice Chair, comments, questions, Senator Courtney? And I don't recall if you've been before the committee, how committee works is we do public hearings 1 week, and because we have so many veterans of a broad category, including World War II veterans who are older, and younger veterans who sometimes don't catch all of the tons of emails and Facebooks that come, we hear a bill 1 week, and then we have the work session the following week. And so we'll place this on the calendar for a work session next week.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the... That's the only person, right? Close the public hearing on HCR 11, and I'm looking to see. Yes, there he is, and he's well. We were all thinking he might have not been well. With that, we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing simultaneously, so Representative Matthews can come up on HCR 4 and House Bill 2422, and welcome back to health. We've missed you.
Yes. Thank you, Mr.
And I have emails in your inbox.
Yes, I've been reading those and catching up. I really appreciate that, and thank you. It's good to be back and good to be healthy. Appreciate that. So thank you for opening these the joint hearing, I suppose. In HCR 4, we'll start there, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. HCR 4 honors Lieutenant Commander Neil Swartout for his heroic acts as a United States Navy pilot during World War II and the Korean War. What I'll do is I'll submit you written testimony. I think that'd be more helpful. And I'll just kind of try to capture just briefly who this man is. We don't have a series of 30, 40 people here. And in fact, Mr. Swartout himself doesn't even know that we're here discussing him right now. The beauty of this bill is Mr. Swartout's a resident of Gresham and shares some time with, I believe, Phoenix, Arizona, and Palm Desert. He's a golfer and a golf fanatic. He's a treasure of the Gresham Golf Course, and if you didn't know any better, you'd just assume he's just a jovial, everyday man. And he's a veteran. And he's a veteran that accomplished great things, and I first learned of him in an article in the Gresham Outlook, and it was written by a friend of mine, Ann Endicott, who had testified in the House hearings and unable to be here today. But she authored a piece on Mr. Swartout kind of detailing his events as a veteran, and captured a real spirit of a humble man, and then identifying the fact that he is a war hero and a distinguished recipient of the Navy Cross, which, as you know, second highest decoration of valor next to the Medal of Honor. He was born in Wisconsin, 1922. Essentially, what Mr. Swartout did, and I think the best to do is read it verbatim off his medal. The official citation states the Navy Cross is awarded to Swartout for extraordinary heroism in operations against enemy fleet units at Kure Harbor, July 28, 1945. Lieutenant Junior Grade Swartout made a skillful, courageous bombing run upon an enemy battleship, scoring direct hit with a 1,000-pound bomb, despite accurate and intense anti-aircraft fire from enemy warships and shore batteries. His attack contributed materially to the heavy damage inflicted upon the enemy vessel. Outstanding courage and determined skill were at all times inspiring, in keeping with the highest traditions of the United Navy service. Well, that's how the U.S. Navy characterizes Mr. Swarthout. But if you asked him, he himself would say, I got a hit on a battleship, and they gave me a Navy Cross. This is just another example of some of the incredible folks we have from our greatest generation that have served this country admirably, and I'm sure hoping that that you can join us as we did in the House and pass HCR 4 and commend his actions as the man that he is. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for having the hearing on this bill.
Thank you for the resolution. Madam Vice Chair.
Yeah. Mayor Courtney.
My father was that way, too.
It's pretty amazing when you meet these folks that don't want to tell you anything about what they've done. They just don't see it as any great feat. And when you hear, they truly are the greatest generation. And as you know, as your committee knows, they're unfortunately passing and leaving us at a rate that we just can't even, fathom. And it's just nice to be able to recognize them while they're here, and to have, I think, a resolution that honors somebody that's able to be present to receive it speaks volumes to their service. So thank you.
Appreciate that. I understand that fully. When I was an NCO, just like you were, I came home in the 70s, and my dad came out to the house I was staying in because, being an NCO from the McHale's Navy sort of environment. He brought a bottle of wild turkey out, and it was the only time he ever talked to me about the war.
Yeah.
And when I became an officer, he disowned me, but that was okay. And he never talked about the military the entire time until he died. But when he died, it was pretty amazing the stories that came back from his events, and people that I had never met in my entire life showed up at his funeral. So it is a strange time. With that, we're going to move on to House Bill 2422. You want to give us a background, counsel, and then, Mr. Mann, if you would be efficient and come up at the same time.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, House Bill 2422 requires the Department of Human Services to communicate veterans' name and address to the Department of Veterans Affairs monthly if authorized by the veteran. When the veteran makes written requests about certain assistance programs, it authorizes DHS to make rules to achieve that end.
Chair.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. This bill is really part of the plan, I suppose, in reaching our veterans. We that deal with the committees and our veterans issues know that 27% of our veterans are receiving benefit. There's a lot of money on the federal level that is not being utilized for their benefits, and we need to find a way to access those dollars. We need to find a way to get in touch with our veterans and identify who they are, and then ask them if they'd like to receive benefit, and perhaps if they'd like us to know who they are. This bill further extends what we've done in the past with BOLI, and this includes DHS. And what I want to say is, rarely said in this building, unfortunately, but I just really want to commend the agency. I just found the efforts of DHS and ODOT, which is another bill currently in Ways and Means, to just be incredibly helpful, participating, volunteering to come forward to find solutions that get us to the point of asking a veteran, are you a veteran, and if so, can we forward your name voluntarily to the ODVA so they can research your veteran benefits. This bill does that at the DHS level. You'll notice there's not a fiscal attached to it. Again, the agency can't say enough great things about them. Tom Mann and, of course, the ODVA and all the folks there, incredible. And if this bill does what we think it'll do, and what so far the bill with BOLI has proven to do, it will put veterans in touch with benefits that they didn't know they accessed. In the end game, in the long run, I hope that those benefits end up meaning that we can reduce some of the state services that perhaps these veterans are on now without knowing they have a benefit to cover. Perhaps it might be health care. Perhaps, it has to do with family services. You just don't know what they're going to be entitled to, education. But they've earned that benefit. And I think that anything we can do to get them in touch with it is great. And when you look at the volume of people that DHS, has within their scope of dealing with, to ask the simple question, are you a veteran, and be able to forward that information with the approval of the veteran, it could have just a monumental change in our state and in the veterans' lives. And again, just one more rung on the ladder of what I hope reaches this $4.2 billion that's out there at the federal level. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the time today and appreciate you hearing the bill, and I will pass it over to my good friend, Mr. Tom Mann.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Outreach has been a significant issue for the agency since the 2008 Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services, where we recognized a gap in reaching veterans in the state. We've done a lot of work with the agencies. ODOT and DHS and Boley and others are extraordinarily good partners with ODVA currently. As a matter of fact, when a person applies for Medicaid in this state, they have to first apply for VA pension. So we already have a relationship with DHS at that level. What this bill does is expand that and codifies it so that we can do more. We know partners such as DHS and ODOT and others have greater reach than ODVA has to reach more people. I believe that DHS reaches 1 million Oregonians. So that kind of reach would allow us to reach a lot more veterans. And as you know, a lot of veterans don't know that there are veteran benefits. So allowing us in a voluntary way to get a spreadsheet once a month or however we decide to do that, to do the outreach we're excited about doing, will allow us to do our job, which is find those veterans and those families, provide them every benefit they earned when they rose their right hand. So we're very excited about this bill.
I appreciate that, and Mr. Chair. The reverse way of telling it, as you and I both share the passion with, is 73% of those guys out there and gals have a benefit, probably. They just don't know it yet. And the more of those we can get onto one of the federal veterans programs, the more funds we have available to help other Oregonians. So once again, it's a veteran sacrificing to help somebody else. We just got to let them know that opportunity exists.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and you're exactly right. And for me, I guess I look at this from a standpoint of the agency, DHS, you know, 1 million folks within under their umbrella, perhaps. DMV, I'm told anywhere from 2.5 to 3.5 million when you take into effect the ID cards, the driver's license, the vehicle registrations, title transfers. That's a lot of folks. They're not all veterans, but to ask the question, we're going to end up capturing a lot of them. And again, getting benefits in their pocket that they have earned and they deserve is really the right step. And again, Mr. Chair, thank you for hearing the bill. And I will, just to prep you, the ODOT bill has a fiscal of $135,000, which is, I think, a very small fiscal. That's $100,000 the first year, $35,000 the second, so $135,000 for the biennium. It's currently on Ways and Means, and I've been working with our co-chair on the importance of accessing those dollars to gain the dollars that will come back to the state.
And if you'd be counsel kind enough to remind me, I will have the same discussion with our co-chair.
Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair? Senator Courtney?
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
No.
But we appreciate the hard work over there, gentlemen. And my assumption is, since DHS is in the room, it passed your chamber and they aren't signed up, that DHS is perfectly happy with this bill. I see heads nodding officially in the back room. Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on HB 2422 and HCR 4. And we're going to open a public hearing on HJM 1. Council, if you would, please. And Lori, if you and whoever would please come forward at the same time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HJM 1, the members will remember, because this committee is the same during the regular session as it was during the interim. This discussion started during the interim, and you've met these folks before. This is a measure, a memorial that urges Congress to overturn the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs regulation prohibiting provision of service or therapy dogs for veterans with emotional and mental disabilities.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Lori Satinspiel, board member, Joys of Living Assistance Dogs. But you didn't know that about me, did you? Here in support today of House Joint Memorial 1, with me is Joy St. Peter, Executive Director and Founder of the Joys of Living Assistance Dog. And for time's sake, I'm just going to speak to the measure, and then you can ask us questions if you wish. Why are we in support? Because our waiting list of veterans with post-traumatic stress that have inquired about a dog is very long. Joys of Living Assistance Dogs is a total volunteer organization, and it takes, depending on the level of need, up to 2 years to provide a dog for anyone with physical disabilities, mental included. This is another segment of the population that's growing. We know that, and we would like to have help with resources so we can expand our organization to help these dogs get out into areas where they're needed. I got an email, Mr. Chair. The veterans supporting us are very prompt. They don't need a week. Hi, Laura. I hope you're doing well. I got the info about HJM 1 for tomorrow. I will not be able to attend because I now have group therapy for post-traumatic stress, Thursday from 1400 hours until 1530. Mr. Chair, you'll have to help me with the official time on that one. And he's supportive of this. He does not have a dog. And he, again, he's going to group therapy, supports this as well. He signs it, respects road dog. He rode in on his Harley last time we heard this bill. So he asked me to pass that along. And I don't know if Joy has anything she'd like to add, but we're just here in support and hope we can move this on.
I would just like to just add that we would really like to move this on because I get phone calls from veterans, and what I often hear is, I can't wait the 2 years or 2.5 years that it takes to get a dog. They don't have enough time. Mentally, they can't hold out that long. I had one veteran get a dog and die 4 months later. Uh-huh. So that's the hard part on our job is we can't get them out fast enough, and we were looking for support because it really does make a difference in their lives.
And for the record, you are?
Oh, for the record, I am Joy St. Peter, founder and director of the Joys of Living Assistance Dogs.
And I'll let you teach her the military clock.
I'm learning.
Madam Vice Chair.
Senator Olson.
I'd just like to say it's a wonderful program, and I support this. You guys should be out there a lot. It's good for the veterans. Anything that's good for the veterans is good for Oregon.
Yeah.
Senator Cordy?
Thank you very much, and we'll place it on the calendar for next week. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on HJM1. For members of the audience, if you'll just bear with us shortly, we're going to open in a moment a work session to introduce committee measures, and then we're going to actually drop to the bottom and do a quick work session to move a bill, and then we're going to come back to the calendar. With that, I'm going to open a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair, before the committee today is LC-3805, dated 3813. It makes the second Sunday of every August the Spirit of 45 Day.
Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following concept be introduced as a committee bill, LC-3805-03, dated 03-08-13.
Vice Chair Mona Sanderson has moved that the legislative concept as recited be introduced as a committee bill. Before I go into discussion, just so everyone knows, this is a World War II commemorative type committee bill, and also a vote in favor merely of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote of merit to the concept and is not indicative of a member's opinion or position or a consent of the measure, simply an introduction. Is there further discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so ordered. With that, we're going to close the work session on possible committee introductions. Colleagues, we're going to drop to the very bottom of the calendar. You'll notice that I did say before 2183 we're going to carry over so that the good chair from the other side of the chamber, the House, can have a discussion on this. But I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2182. Madam Counsel.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, House Bill 2182, you'll recall, was previously heard on March 7th. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It has no subsequent referral. Representative Boone testified this is the measure that designates every September 27th First Responder Appreciation Day. It moved off of the floor and out of committee unanimously on the House side.
On the House side. Thank you. Is there discussion? Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2182 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves House Bill 2182 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. We have a volunteer. Senator Olson is being recognized for being voluntold. We do appreciate that. And he will be the carrier for the bill. With that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2182. Back for members of the public, what we're going to do is have a short informational meeting only on the Kimball report, and then make a few comments on earthquake administrative drills. So I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Kimball report. I do want, for the record, it has a bill attached to this. What we're doing, colleagues and members of the public, is simply reviewing the Kimball report that came in on 911, and it's really just a discussion of what that report says and how we would go forward. And I don't mean in consolidation, I mean what authority would be required to go forward at some point in the future. We're not intending to take any action outside of that. So
since we don't have a tee-up, somebody pick lead or follow up there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. And with us today, we have two representatives from Kimball, who we have contracted with to do several projects for us, reference 911. With me on my right is R.D. Porter. Far right is Sarah Weston, and of course, Mark Tennyson, who's our director of our 911 communications section inside the Office of the Emergency Management. So I think an attempt to try to whip through this and not too many take too long to accommodate your schedule, but nonetheless, we thought it was important that you get a full understanding of what we've been up to with respect to this whole arena. So with that, I'll turn it over to R.D. and let you take off.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm R.D. Porter. I'm a senior public safety consultant for L.R. Kimball, and we'd really like to go through this briefly to explain to you what the business case for the next generation 911 technology and what it focuses on. The five topics we're going to talk about today, of course, will be the business case purpose, why did we do this, the background, what the scope of what we've done, the problems and opportunities that were being faced, and then the two major ones, the alternatives and the consequences of failure to act, will be the two major topics of discussion. The first thing would be the business case. Our initial issue was to identify any problems we have within the Oregon 911 system. The second thing that we need to look at is how do we address consolidation on a statewide perspective. The background to this report is that we looked at actually the 911 call taking and processes itself, strictly from the time a caller picks up the phone till it gets to a 911 center and sent to a first responder. What we did not address in this report is the local dispatching function, the radio piece, and that is a local issue that still needs to be dealt with at a local level. The problems that we needed to address, one is the public expectations. In the systems today, the technology the general public have, they expect to use their technology to contact 911 at any given time. The other issue is the fact that the state of Oregon 911 systems are on an outdated platform. Their technology is technically really end of life. The vendors they have bought this from have said, we will no longer support it. You're going to have to migrate to a new environment. The third item we come across in the problems is the fact that the escalating cost of maintaining the current system, the costs continue to climb to maintain those systems. Some of the opportunities that we did define was the fact that now would be the time for the state of Oregon to look to migrate into a new digital network environment. Rather than try to fix something at all, let's look at how can we migrate into the new one. The other key thing that we came across was the fact that by doing the migration, it will fall in line with the state of Oregon's policies and plans that they've developed for public safety. So, if we could, the alternatives. We took three alternatives. Alternative one was to stay at the status quo. Don't change anything. Of course, we do not recommend that. Alternative two is a next generation 911 implementation of all the PSAPs within the state of Oregon and do this prior to doing consolidation. Have consolidation be an organic platform based on a new network. And of course, the third one is if we just do mandated call center consolidation. And that's not recommended. And we'll explain why. Alternative one on the status quo, what we're ending up with, if we don't do anything, the technology that you have today is going to have to be replaced. No matter what you do, it's going to be replaced. Now, the thing of it is, what's the cost of that going to happen? The other thing that we have to take a look at is, in today's environment, if you lose a 911 center, that whole region that it's connected to is isolated. There's no redundancy or backups to that environment. So if you look at that environment today, you could lose a whole segment of the state by one center or one telephone company central office going down. The other one is you're going to have substantial financial implications. We'll show you that And the current environment, there's no way to curtail the cost because you're maintaining an outdated system, and the longer you maintain that, the higher the cost goes to take care of it. And this graph kind of shows you what we've looked at. When we done the analysis, we actually took the numbers from 2010, 2011, and 2012, checked those numbers on the growth pattern, and they're showing an average of 4.5% increase annually. This chart shows that continued growth of 4.5% across a 10-year time span. And alternative two, this is the alternative that we do highly recommend. And what it would do, it would improve 911 environment for all the citizens and all the visitors to the state of Oregon. Now, it would improve all the current system deficiencies. And when I say system deficiencies, they were talking about the ability to take messages from cell phones, photographs, text when that becomes available, any other method of communication to 911 other than the standard voice connection. The other thing we're looking at is if you build your next-gen network out there, your next-gen 911 network out there, and deploy that statewide, that will provide an opportunity for those PSAPs locally to join together and connect into that network and utilize and share all the resources that are on that system. And finally, the other thing I think is dramatically important is the ability to reroute calls that you don't have today. In a new environment, if you lose a call center, then all those calls are electronically rerouted to the next closest call center. You don't have that hole that exists when you've lost that central office or you've lost that 911 center. Alternative cost, the two, we've identified those up there. And you can see from year one to year two, there's an increase in cost initially. And the purpose of that is the fact that you have to maintain two networks while you're doing the implementation. You have to maintain the analog network and the current network, plus you have to deploy your new one. So in this two-year time frame, there is a cost increase, but it's only while you're doing the implementations. In the public safety environment, where we don't have the luxury of shutting one off and building another one, this transition has to be seamless. So in order to do that, for the time being, you have to maintain two networks. That's why they're showing that cost for year one and year two kind of increasing. But when you look at year three and year four from there on, those prices stabilize. And then that's where you start showing your savings. Alternative three, mandated consolidation. And as it says there, currently, and I say currently because we're aware there is a bill here in the legislature to resolve that, but there is no statutory authority to consolidate PSAPs. The other issue with trying to consolidate them is you're going to really put a burden on the state's 911 resources. When you try to migrate those into a single environment, all the technology out there has got to be replaced, but you're still running on an old network. So you buy new technology, but you have to downgrade it to fit the transport mechanism which it runs on. That's a huge cost item. The other thing that you look at, if they look at alternative three, when they spend the money to replace the equipment and downgrade it to ride the network, that takes less revenue out of the state's funds in order to build a new network to bring things back up to where they need to be. So it truly is a regressive path to make that migration. The other thing I'd like to address is the last issue there, is mandating consolidation does provide for a very fractured, inefficient, and really a not a very good system. We have seen this tried in other states, and we can assure you that when you force a PSAP to do something they're not required to do and not don't want to do, you're going to have insurmountable problems. And I would say in 90% of the cases where this has occurred, it has reverted back to a single standalone PSAP. And there's been hard feelings and animosities between those that originally tried to come together, but it was because they were forced. Organic consolidation proves to be much easier and provides for greater opportunities. And that's the key to that system. The cost, and I think these costs are extremely important at this point. When we look at what we're looking at up there from the CAMA trunking, that's an old telephony call associated management accounting system that the phone company used to manage their phone bills back in the 60s. They converted that into making 911 systems. That's what you're paying for right now, basically a 45 to 50-year-old environment. The CPE, or computer or customer premise-based equipment, that's predominantly your 911 call-taking equipment, your call-logging equipment, all those devices, those are going to stay the same. What we can't determine at this point is our current carrier cost. And the reason for that is because depending on how this consolidation goes and crossing all the telephony ladder boundaries or the local area territory arrangements that they have, crossing those boundaries is a huge cost item. And until we identify where those nine PSAPs would be, we cannot identify what the current network cost would be. The other issue I think we need to address here is the fact that this is just from the transport position. This does not include the facilities. Depending on where these nine regions would be, you'd have to not only build a facility, and that could run, depending on the size of the facility, between $1 to $5 million. Plus, you'd have to purchase the land, manage all that total environment. So, if we could go to the next slide, please. If we take a look at your potential building cost, if it's a small PSAP operation of five workstations, and that would be the smallest, you're looking at an estimated cost of $1.75 million to take care of that. Now, what that does not include any of the internal environmental controls, workstations, equipment, or the property to build that facility. So the state on a five-position one would have to spend up to $1.7 million just for the building itself. When you look at that for nine times nine, and it could change dramatically. We look here at the alternative cost. They're the three topics that we looked at. If you look at alternative three, and I'll start over there because that's the diagram that shows the cost for one. One of those could run generally between $1.75 to $5 million, depending on the size. And if you do that times nine, that's at least $45 million that the state would have to spend just to build a facility and get it stocked. That does not talk about the maintenance of it. If you look at alternative one, staying at the current status, we've projected that in year four, you're going to be spending $13.83 million annually to maintain an outdated system. Our recommended plan, if you take a look at that at year four and ongoing, we're looking at the average cost being $7.16 million, just about half what it would be if you maintained the current system. How did we establish our alternatives and which one we recommended? We took a look at eight separate functions and gauged all three alternatives against those eight separate functions. And as you can see on the slide, the only one that met every criteria that we put together was the middle one. Now, the goals or criteria was developed before we looked at the alternatives, because we really wanted to take a fair look at this. And based on those eight items, only the second alternative met every request. Now, our consequences if we don't do anything. If you don't do anything, everything stays the way it is, your system is going to be degraded. It's going to continue to go down. As technology improves, your ability to receive those calls are going to dramatically decrease. The expense to maintain this network is going to continue to grow. Yet your revenues are pretty stable. There's not that 4.5% growth pattern built in. At some point, your state fund is going to be losing money by staying where you're at and not doing anything. The last one there, if you don't do anything, basically you're putting your own citizens and your guests of the state of Oregon in jeopardy. The technology they're carrying in their pockets today, 911 centers cannot receive information from that unless it's strictly a voice call. We'll open up for questions.
Can you go back one slide? So then, if no action is taken, we got that one. So we want to act. So describe to us how we want to act. What do we want to do?
What our suggestion is that the state look at deploying a next generation network. Build that network out. That would take 2 to 5 years, depending on the environment. Once that network's built out, then through your state funding schemas, allow PSEPs to connect into that network. And based on the criteria of that connection, that would determine how those PSEPs might consolidate with each other, how you can put a regional environment in, but that would all be from a local perspective. It's not the state forcing the local to do something. It's kind of like you all built the highway to get to their city. Now it's their job to build their city for that highway. So whether you want a lot of little towns or one major town, it's the locals who make that decision. But what has happened now, the state has started saving money because you're not paying for all that infrastructure and all that technology on the local level that is outdated. Now you've got a new system at half the price and allows better functionality for the locals to connect into it.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I just make a quick comment. We, 2 years ago when we first had these discussions about this very same subject, with a lot of intensity, we had 49 PSAPs, wasn't it? 49 PSAPs. Okay. Today we're down to 46. When this program started, the legislature passed it in 1981, got implemented statewide by about 1983, there was 212 PSAPs. So I think it's clear that, you know, this has been happening organically, naturally, and as we see the costs go up of all the other things that local government's experiencing right now, in other testimony before this committee and other committees on this subject, approximately 70% of the cost of running that public service answering point is borne by the local governments. Typically, 25 to 30% is paid for by the state, and then of course we have the responsibility for the backbone. So, as costs have been squeezed at the local level, they've looked at alternatives on how they can get together and, you know, be efficient and also economical. So, I think we're going to continue to see that. Every indication that we see is going to provide that. By going to the next generation, we will be able to knock down some of the barriers that are causing some of that problem right now, just in technology. And already mentioned LATAs. We had a situation between two counties here in Oregon that they wanted to consolidate, or they were looking at consolidation. But by going across that LATA, every time a call came in from one organization that got shipped out of the county to get answered by another one, it was a cost, it was a fee, because it went across that boundary, and vice versa. So by going to the new system, next generation, I think we'll avoid a good deal of that, because it'll be internet-based, and then those LATA charges will not be going on every single call that goes in and out, which again will then make it the environment. So I think you'll see locals then say, wow, now the technology's there, we're going to save some money, and we can now look seriously at consolidation. So I think that's one leads to the other one, in my opinion.
So then, because the goal has been, how do we incentivize this? How do we not get stuck with the tar baby? Okay, and how do we incentivize it? So I guess my question is what authority is needed to move the direction of the new technology, and what does it cost?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're already in the process with some RFPs that are out on the street right now. They're not completed yet. We're working closely with the LFO. They have been intimately involved in this, and I'm going to turn to Mark and ask him what the numbers are from your best guess, and also the time frames that we're looking at.
Senator Boquist, excuse me, members of the committee, again, Mark Tennyson, the state 911 program director. As General Caldwell said, I'm not going to give you a dollar figure today because, to be honest, I'd be guessing. Through the business case process on NextGen that RD just described to you, we OEM went through and through the RFP process hired a consultant that is helping us draft an RFP that will actually give us the pricing and hopefully the solution that we're looking for to move to this next generation 911 technology that you've heard described today. Prior to that, the state 911 program, with the help of our consultant on the RFP, RCC is the name of the consultant, we did a request for information, a week-long session, where we had several vendors come in and give us information, in some cases a little bit of pricing, but again, very high level. So we've got some idea, and we've included that and updated that in our business case that was submitted. So as we get through and get the RFP released, we'll have a much better idea what that will look like.
Might add one other thing, Mr. Chairman. As we've looked at this thing initially early on when we first started looking at it, we realized that the quicker we can move to the next generation technology, the quicker we're going to start saving some significant dollars, as you saw on those slides that were just presented. And we think, you know, we've even debated about coming back to maybe the next session of the legislature and looking for bonding authority to do it quicker and convert everybody sooner than not. We haven't made that decision yet. I'm not certain that we will. We're going to have to let this thing play out so we have all the information. But you talked about incentives. One of the things we discussed and we have discussed internally, and we're still working with our partners, our local partners, we won't have enough money to get everybody there initially. We know that under the current scheme of maneuver with respect to the funding. What we had thought about, and we haven't implemented, of course, but we're thinking about dividing the state up basically in three tiers. One tier being the most heavily used 911 centers that get most of the calls, making that tier one and say, these are going to get converted first. We're going to get the equipment in there, get the backbone established, then get the equipment in there first because they have the highest volume of calls. The second level, we'll get to second level when we can get to second level based on the funding and replace your equipment and get you involved. The third tier would be the smaller PSAPs. In some counties, as you know, we've got three PSAPs out there, and they're rather rural counties. Our strategy or our thoughts on that would say we'll incentivize it by saying if you consolidate and two or more of you get together and become a three to one, then you get to move up a tier or perhaps two tiers. So now you'll get new equipment, get funded sooner, thereby incentivizing it without taking a hammer and beating them up. And say that otherwise you're going to have to wait till the money's available and we'll get to you as quick as we can. Now, that's one way to look at it. Certainly, it's no guarantee that everybody would do that, but in some instances, I think you'd find that happening because of the local squeeze and the money they're putting out right now for manning these centers.
So, Paul, do you have the authority now to move forward?
Mr. Chairman, no. We're working again. We're in a process that LFO prescribed 2 years ago. Yeah, 2 years ago now. So we have the authority to do the research, but we are in conjunction with DAS and LFO to make sure as we move through this, and we're going to a new high technology system, that we don't end up like some other examples that we're all aware of that have happened throughout the years. So they're very, very involved, and so yes, we're moving forward. So we have that authority, but we're involved with them at every step of the way, so we don't get ahead of our skis.
The only concern that I have, and we'll go on to the folks, but is the time frame it takes to get redundancy. You were here last week, the other members weren't, and you know, when the ground shakes at 9-0, and as you point out, there is no redundancy, you got a whole bunch of centers that are just going to vaporize with everything else. And when you don't have redundancy, even if you can establish a chain of calves, sell on wheels, or reestablish communications, you still don't have the center. So without establishing, for better word, the loop or the technology so that you can get transferable redundancy sooner, not later, that becomes very problematic.
Do you want to talk to that?
Sure. RD, do you want to explain?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, the environment that I think we've described here, and that was one of the first things we talked about in Alternative 1, there is no redundancy and no recoverability in a catastrophic disaster. In Alternative 2, by building that network first and having the PSAPs connect into that, That network is on, and I won't describe it as a loop system, but it will have backward and forward compatibility. You can lose any one piece of it. The rest of the network, if it's designed properly, would still function. Anything in that environment would then connect into that network and go to the next closest emergency answering point that was still functioning. And that's all done in the programming of the system itself. When you develop this hardware that runs on that supports this network, there's automatic failovers. We just finished a project in another state where if we lost a PSAP on the east side of the state, we had the ability through those data centers to route those calls anywhere within that state that we deemed necessary, or we could route those calls out of state. So it's all in your hardware infrastructure and how you set up that network, but that will provide complete redundancy in any case, even up to the fact they had two data centers, but if you lost one, the other one would carry the full load.
One final question, and we'll go to Madam Vice Chair. The dollar figure estimates thrown here, is that per center, per system? What's the rough ballpark figure of these numbers?
On alternative two, those numbers are for the network itself.
Right.
And the 911 call-taking equipment in those 48, 47, 46, whatever number PSAPs, we based our assumptions and our numbers off of 49 PSAPs. When the numbers we originally generated, that's what you had. But in that length of time, you've already dropped at least three more.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair?
My question may have nothing to do with this, but my cable company told me to that because I'm not digital, I have the old-fashioned TVs that I have three, you know, so I had to have a converter to digital. And I said, well, why do I have to do this? Why are we making this change? And they said it had to do with emergency communication and that it would take me off of a bandwidth because there's problems with, you know, overloading the system. Is this related to 911 communications or is that a totally different issue?
Yes.
Without understanding your specific cable company's design, based on what you have just stated, that's totally separate and apart from anything. There should not be anything involved with your cable system that's connected into the 911 system unless you have a voice over internet protocol type telephone device and you're getting your voice services from that cable company. So without those two exceptions, those two networks will never meet.
Okay.
But it's very similar. What you described is very similar to what the state's facing now from the 911 centers. They have the old technology. Mm-hmm. There's a new network out there, but you got to have this device, and we call it a gateway controller or network gateway that actually converts digital technology back to an analog technology so the locals can receive it. It's very similar to your television system.
So we're not going to get rid of analog. Or is that what the new system would be, getting rid of the old?
The old system, the old analog system's going away.
Okay.
It's kind of like the steam engine. They work great, but eventually something new came along. And in the analog environment, the phone companies have found that it's not a profit center for them anymore. So they're migrating into a digital high-tech environment.
Okay.
But if you want steam engines and you let us cut trees, we can deal with that.
Senator Olson?
Yes, a couple questions. I have a little bit of knowledge of this. What's our goal to get down to how many PSAPs? I know our original concept was 9, General. Is that still on the drawing board?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the 9 PSAPs, again, Kimball had done a study, and they said if this was a perfect world and a blank canvas, and we were building a new system, this is how we'd probably build it, given the technology today. We haven't not necessarily set a goal. It's not legislated at this point. I firmly believe that at some point in most areas you could have one per county would be more than adequate. Having said that, there's another problem with, not a problem, there's another tweak with this system that we created in 1981, and that is that you can't really divorce the dispatch of the emergency service worker, police, fire, whatever the case may be, from the call taking. And that's typically how it's done in Oregon. One person gets the call in, they dispatch the proper equipment and people to that particular scene. The law actually says that the state pay only for the call taking. So when you go to 9 regional PSAPs, if that was the case, or pick a number, then essentially those local governments have still got to maintain that dispatch, because the call would come in and they would dispatch, let's say we had one in Medford, and they'd dispatch over to Klamath Falls, or they'd dispatch over to Lakeview. Well, somebody's got to take that call and dispatch it to the local person. So you kind of got a mixed bag here, and I think the way that typically if we had the first responders up here, they'd tell you, yes, we do it all seamlessly. We do it one at a time. We take the call, we dispatch, done. You don't pass it off. So the same person took the call actually does the dispatch, and that is, we believe, an efficient way to do business. And most of the law enforcement folks that we've talked to and the first responders say that's the way we want it. We want it that way because we have direct contact with the person who took the call, so it's all linked.
You know, we've talked about this before, that I've always looked at the fact that we should have a diamond backup series of PSAPs, one in the north, one in the south, one on the coast, and one in the east. And that would integrate into the system you're talking about, the 9. But mine related on the fact that we kept our PSAPs, but if there was a catastrophe, there would be an integrated switchover so that Medford could dispatch in Portland, or Portland can dispatch on the coast, or whatever. Would your technologies be able to work in that context?
Absolutely.
From a call-taking perspective, that was the whole purpose of this, was to allow that functionality.
Well,
but from a dispatch, radio dispatch right. function, that's a totally separate issue that the locals would have to deal with.
Follow-up, please. It's quite interesting because I actually have 2 911 bills that I'll testify on today, and I'd love to use your work here because it fits quite nicely into what I have. but the last thing I'd like to ask, General, we know that, as a matter of fact, I will say this on the record, he bailed me out a couple years ago from a mess that I was in, but we know that the 911 community is very tight-knit. And do you think that this plan would we be able to move this plan through the 911 community? I'm not saying seamlessly, but to get them to understand that this is the best intervention.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, the 911 community supports wholeheartedly the move to the next generation. These are the practitioners. They know how this system works. They're very knowledgeable about it through their lane that they're in all the time, and they support going to the next gen wholeheartedly. I'd be shocked, and I know that their representative was in the back of the room, but she's left. She was here, but clearly this is the right move. They understand that. They recognize that. They know they'll be more efficient. They know they'll be faster and able to take care of the citizens a lot better.
Thank you, sir.
So I'll follow up on that. I think the answer to the real question is that they can't afford to pay for it, right?
Mr. Chairman.
Who pays for it? That's the question.
Mr. Chairman, under the current law, which is up in several different forms in this legislative session to reauthorize, pick one. but I think that's where Sina went, because they're having one in the House today about this very thing, about extending the current law. 35% of the funds collected go to run this backbone. So that's the state cost. That's what we as a state agency have to provide so the locals can connect into it, basically. So it won't change. We have no proposals to change that split, but they wouldn't be burdened with that. And we buy the equipment inside of their PSAPs. The state buys that, the backbone and the equipment. Their major cost is personnel. That's their biggest single cost, which is driving, you know, because of the lack of funds to supply adequate money. Some PSAPs operate almost exclusively on state money. The smaller ones, but the bigger ones that have the most use, they don't. They're operating at 75%, some of them even close to 80% local monies. That answers your question.
Mr. President, I do have another question concerning this. In my various travels around the state, I found that the PSAPs work on different software. Would we incorporate into this the knowledge and into the bill that the software would be compatible, although might not be from the same supplier, they all would be compatible so they could all just talk with each other, because right now they can't? or would we go with one supplier of one software for the entire state?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the goal is clearly that we would have everybody on the same plane. They would have the same level of equipment, which, as I mentioned earlier, if it was a perfect world and we had the money, we'd convert everybody automatically as fast as we could. And then I think you'd see that consistency where we've had some ups and downs in the past because we haven't been able to do it. But if we could do it in 2 to 3 years, we would have compatibility with all. It may not be the same vendor, but they'd have to be compatible. We can't have that.
As you know, that's one drum I've been beating for last 2 years.
Yes, sir. I know that.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, to maybe add on to that, your question. Again, it kind of goes back to funding. As you've heard earlier today, the state funding covers the backbone. So, of course, obviously, we would need to have interoperability on that network so that any PSAP that's on there could receive calls, transfer calls, and as you heard from RD, if there's a disaster, we could transfer to another state data center and diversity and so forth. But again, the challenge is at the local level. As you know, sir, I've been at some of the PSAPs. The radios don't all talk to each other, so it's still an issue at the local level that there's still a challenge with funding, and not only that, but the interoperability that they would still be borne on their behalf to fund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, to more specific to your question, would all the technology be able to communicate? From a next generation 911 perspective, that's the ultimate goal of this system, that regardless of the manufacturer, the equipment will communicate with each other. Regardless of where it's located, how it's configured, its basic roots, they all are the same.
Good. Thank you.
Well, I hope so, because General Caldwell, I think you were a lieutenant when we talked about joint operations communications in the military, and we're, I don't know, $50 billion later?
Yes.
And they still can't talk to each other, so we send a runner down the hall?
Yes, sir. Smoke signals, string and 210 cans.
Yeah, right. So I do see that. I mean, and I appreciate the presentation. I think the question is we can't leave the session without a roadmap forward, because we've already spent this topic came up when Senator Verger and I were together, and I was a House member, and we're still talking the same topic going hard. And I hear you that you're talking to the dungeon people over there in Ways and Means, but the question comes down is there needs to be a roadmap forward, and at least some grasp of, you know, what those costs are, and does the authority exist, and, you know, in the next 18 months, you know, how do we make progress? Because, you know, we started talking 9-0 earthquakes in 2005. It's 8 years later. So if we had a 50-year plan back then, we'd be at year 42 and be a long ways down the road. Senator Olson, you have one final thing?
Well, I'd just like to say that on the assumption that this will move forward, which I assume it will, I would like to, since I'm going to be volunteered anyhow, I'd like to volunteer to go ahead and work with it with the group and see if I can be the liaison between Veterans Committee and the working folks.
Well, since you volunteered, because we do need to have a grasp at the legislative level before we leave this session of what is the way ahead, other than the Ways and Means process, you are so tasked.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate that.
Any other discussions? If not, gentlemen, ladies, I appreciate the information. The committee appreciates the information, and we will probably get back to this hopefully towards the end of session, hopefully not towards the end of June. Some of us like to leave before the end of June. So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on the Kimball report. Thank you very much. I do want to make one comment, colleagues, on earthquake administrative rules. There's some discussion in that in regards to 2183, which I mentioned that Representative Matthews and I are having. But on our webpage or in our links or someplace along that line, there's a couple of 3-minute and 10-minute little videos that we chose not to take our time here, that if you take time to glance at those, you'll see why our legislative administrator told people it might not be a good idea to crawl under our desks in our chamber. But with that, I want to go on to the public hearings. We're going to go ahead and move on to SB 127. At this point, I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 127. Just for the record, this is a placeholder for discussions that came out of the resilience report, and
we're only really opening the public hearing. We'll let council talk briefly to see if there's anybody here to testify on 127. But in a week from now, we're going to have a report from the petroleum industry coming back and talking to us, somebody down from the state of Washington, in regards to the resilience report and how we might be able to, over the next 50 years, come up with a way to access emergency fuels across the state. Madam Counsel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to dovetail what you said previously on the drills, we did post on OLIS the two links to the videos regarding the Triangle of Life, and we received also some written testimony from Dr. McConnell at Dugami on the same subject, and we'll post that as well. Senate Bill 127, a bill originated from a citizen in Coos Bay, I believe, who was ordered to evacuate and had difficulty getting fuel, and a bill was drafted based on that to permit customers to operate appropriately equipped gas pumps when they were ordered to evacuate in a bona fide emergency. And there was discussion of an amendment to perhaps replace the measure requiring installation instead of generator drops at new gas stations or upon the significant remodel or upgrade of an existing gas station as a potential way to make use of the measure.
And again, colleagues, if you recall, during the Oregon Resilience Plan, there was discussions about the problems of accessing fuel, and then in turn to that of, you know, one of the ways forward that the director of ODOT had mentioned was is in future building codes address the issue of setting up generator drops what's through there. We are going to have a report next week, but since this is a placeholder and we're all running out of time on our calendar and we only meet once a month, we did schedule the public hearing so that we'll be in a place to do something if we can do with that. And I don't think anybody has signed up to testify, unless General Caldwell is overwhelmingly wants to give us some time, we can put this off till next week. Okay. There's no comments on SB 127. Close the public hearing on SB 27. Because there are quasi-related and there's people bouncing between rooms, I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 597 and SB 598 at the same time. Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 597 reiterates that funds held in the emergency communications account must be used for purposes described in ORS 403-240, requires statutory change to deviate from purposes described therein, and it declares an emergency is effective on passage. Senate Bill 598 applies only to multi-line telephone systems installed a year or more after passage. It requires operators to enable public safety answering points, that's PSAPs, to obtain street address and building name at a minimum from automatic location identification database for 911 calls. It exempts operators of key telephone systems, wireless telecommunications, and multi-line systems serving single-level, single-track structures of 10,000 square feet or less. It requires diligent efforts by managers to ensure user awareness of 911 call procedures. It requires operators to arrange an update of the automatic location identification database upon the installation of a new phone system that will enable PSAPs to obtain 911 caller address and callback number. Provides civil immunity for 911 jurisdictions, complying providers, manufacturers, managers, and operators, and then defines its terms.
And thank you, Madam Counsel. And members, you'll remember that 598 and the multi-line telephone system is an ongoing issue that we've had from quite some time. And Senator Olson was kind enough to be voluntold on several work groups. Senator Olson, is there anybody you want to join you?
Anybody want to come up?
Nope,
nobody does. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Olson. I am a senator representing Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. Look at the reinforcements are here. That's sergeant reinforced by generals. That's pretty good. I'd like to talk first off about 911 and the necessity of it and the fact that we have, shall I say, used and abused it, if you will. The 911 call centers get their funding from a fee that's put on our telephones of 75 cents. That fee was originally started long ago and converted from 3% up to 5% and then went to a straight 75-cent charge. What has happened over the years is this money has been swept, if you will. And it was very good that that L.R. Kimball came in and did their discussion, because if you look at the alternative to two costs and you see the fact that we need $6 million in year one and $9 million in year two, I will say that in 2001, the 911 enhanced account was swept for $1.754 million. In 2002, the 911 account was swept for $9 million. And in 2007, an attempt was made to sweep $9 million, and that legislation was vetoed. In 2009, $3,112,000 was swept, along with an additional $500,000, which totals about $14 million plus. The point I'm trying to get to is this. 911 is critical, and it's a life-saving function. If you're out on the highway and you've had a car accident and you dial 911, you expect someone to come and get you and save your life. Without the new technologies that are available that Kimball had just mentioned, we can't find you sometimes. And the reason we can't find you is we can't buy the new equipment. And we can't buy the new equipment because those funds were swept. If one looks back at the $14 million, or for example, House Bill 3199 in 2009 that redirected the interest from the 911 account into the general funds, which total about $750,000 to $1 million. These monies right now could pay for year one, year two of our alternative two-cost program from L.R. Kimball. So I'd like to say, colleagues, members of the Veterans Committee, that to sweep 911 funds sometimes would seem like a necessity for other programs. But picture yourself on that road, requiring that service, requiring that 911 system to work for you, to come and save your life, and find that it can't do it because the technology that is currently available is not available in the 911 centers because we could not afford it because we've swept the funds. So basically, Senate Bill 597 says that the funds are available to be swept, but we must declare a fiscal emergency, and that fiscal emergency must be declared by the governor, and it must be 12% below the estimated revenues that we would take in. Sounds like a big hurdle. If we get there, we need the money. There's no question about it. But most times, we need it to balance budgets and to put into other programs. And to me, saving a person's life is much more important than any other program we have. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. We concur with Senator Olson's bill, 597. We think it does precisely what he indicated. I won't reiterate that. And it also has a trigger in there for a fiscal emergency, which I think is a wise piece to have in the bill. No point in me restating everything he said because he's right on point.
You're just along for the ride?
He's here for the next one.
Yes, I'm 598.
We're going to go around on a 598, Senator Olson.
Is there any questions?
This is a contentious issue, Mr. Chair. Sweeping funds. I remember when we had to sweep a lot of funds. I mean, I think we've had to sweep funds several times, and it started when the Republicans were in control back in 2001 or 3 or 5.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, regardless of party, regardless of your political affiliation, regardless of your religion, 911 monies are critical to save children, to save elderly, to save any one of us. And if we keep these funds where they belong, where we can get to this new technologies and pay for these new technologies, we can save many more lives than if we were to pilfer that money and put it into programs that are appropriate and good. But these funds are to save our life, and that's all I have to say about that.
Next bill. 598.
I've got a bunch of these. Could you? Well, I'm sorry. Make a general run it over. Chair Bocas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Olson. I'm a state senator representing Senate District 20, which is the heart of Clackamas County. I'm here today to speak to you about Senate Bill 598, which is a bill that deals with next-generation technologies. Now, we've just heard this with the Kimball report, but this bill deals specifically, or more specifically, with buildings and buildings that would be built in the future. In 2011, I was tasked by the chair of Senate Veterans and Military Affairs to lead a work group of stakeholders in the 911 industry to produce a bill that would allow our new technologies available to the 911 community to be integrated into statewide use. Senate Bill 598 is the instrument we produced after two large work groups and a smaller meeting of concerned stakeholders. This bill was heard in February of 2012, but was not subsequently moved out of committee. The bill simply states that if any entity was to construct a new building larger than 10,000 square feet that would require a multi-line telephone system, the telephone system must be able to identify to the 911 center some basic geographic information about the location from which the 911 call was placed. This would include street address, building number, and if more than one story building, the room number, if available, of the placed call. These protocols should allow for a faster response time from the emergency responders and could therefore save more lives in the process. This bill is a forward-looking piece of legislation that only makes requirements on future development and does not require existing structures to upgrade to this technology. I will admit that the new technologies are coming on in the market every day, so this bill probably has a limited lifespan. And the reason I say that, sir, chair, and members, is, for example, wireless subscribers in 1999, which are cell phone users, 914,848. Today we have 3.5 million. That's a 274% increase. Wired carriers or wired phones, 2,152,000. Today we're down to 1,554,000. That's a 27% decrease. VoIP subscriptions in 2008 had 270,000, and in 2011, 419. That's 55% increase. And then the ILECs, we had in 1999, we had 2 million. We're down to 895,000, which is a 57% decrease. And in the CLECs, we had 47,000. We now have 659,000, which is a 1,295% increase. So my point being is that this bill probably has a limited lifespan because technology changes so rapidly. But it is still a good bill, still should move forward, so that when we have new buildings, new high-rises, buildings such as our own, for example, we had an emergency this week. If that, in fact, had truly happened and you were trapped in this building and we had these new technologies, we could know exactly what floor and what room you're in. And those are the kind of technologies we need to save lives. So in closing, Mr. Chair and members, I think that this bill and we as legislatures for this bill to promote this bill forward for the new technologies that can save lives in the future. I think we have an opportunity here. I think I actually worked with this work group for a couple years now, and I kind of said that we'd get some bills forward for them. This bill didn't move last year, and I think it'd be a good bill to move this year. So I'll entertain any questions if you have any.
General Caldwell first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I concur with the Senator.
Okay. Go ahead. Move faster.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I am Mark Tennyson, Director of the State 911 Program within the Office of Emergency Management. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 598, which establishes requirements for 911 calls placed from multi-line telephone systems. In the 911 business, every second counts when public safety responders are attempting to quickly ascertain a caller's location and provide help. These response times are often delayed in situations where a 911 caller is located in an industrial complex or campus environment, as many times one primary phone number or address is used for all buildings. Senate Bill 598 seeks to require an emergency response location identifier that includes at least a street address and building name for the location from which a 911 call originates. The bill, as Senator Olson mentioned, would not affect a multi-line telephone system serving a workplace of less than 10,000 feet and also does not impact wireless telecommunication services. Currently, 22 states have 911 legislation enacted or pending that requires organizations over a certain size or purchasing a new phone system to provide information so that the appropriate primary safety answering point, or PSAP, is able to query the automatic location identification database and obtain caller location information accurately. The Office of Emergency Management supports this bill and, in fact, any bill that provides public safety answering points and public safety responders with more accurate critical location information necessary to locate 911 callers and an emergency. This concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Vice Chair, question? Thank you, gentlemen. Daryl Fuller, Craig Huddyman, Hasina Squires.
Thank you.
Be helpful if you have comments on 597 first, followed by your comments on 598.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Craig Huddyman, Legislative Director, League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state of Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 597 and want to thank Senator Olson for bringing this bill. The League has been very active this session in support of the 911 tax system. We've testified previously in support of the extension of the tax, which is scheduled to sunset in 2014, the inclusion of prepaid devices under the tax, and recently, as recently as a couple of days ago, testified on a similar bill in the House, House Bill 2179, relating to sweeps. So, it should come as no surprise to learn that the League wholeheartedly supports Senate Bill 597 and the requirement that the revenues derived from this tax be dedicated exclusively to the emergency communications account. Tax covers roughly 30% of the cost of running the system. The balance is borne by local governments. Any sweep of principal or interest, which is already statutorily allowed, places an additional funding burden on local governments at a time they can ill afford it. We concur with the proposal that the bill's prohibition of sweeps from the emergency communications account, the monies distributed to the 911 governing authority, should also apply to the 911 enhanced subaccount, which are funds critical to OEM's management or maintenance and upgrade of the emergency communications equipment. And then finally, there's an issue of federal money. It's my understanding that the state of Oregon, when we do these sweeps, winds up on somebody's, I believe it's the FCC's, naughty list. Basically, what happens is that we are disqualified from applying for federal grants in support of emergency communication systems. So, although I can't tell you what has been foregone in terms of lost opportunity revenues there, it seems to cities that this might be a valuable resource going forward that we ought not to disqualify ourselves from. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Daryl.
Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Thank you for holding a hearing on Senate Bill 597. We wholeheartedly support any effort to increase and fully fund 911. The less state support that is available requires cities and counties and fire districts and other agencies to backfill 911, which eliminates critical money that we need to do what we're being paid to do, which is answer the calls for the 911 center and go out and help people. And so we're fully in support of the bill and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Squires. I'm here on behalf today of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the APCONINA, which is the professional organization that represents the 911 centers, the PSAPs. Senator Olson clearly outlined the provisions of the bill. I will just like to say a few things about our support for this bill. We've supported this bill for several sessions. So we're back, and I want to highlight a few things. Yes, this tax has been diverted six times. And three of the six times, that legislation was vetoed by then-Governor Kitzhaber and or Kulongoski. $1.75 million back in 2001 for OSP equipment. We had three special legislative sessions. They were very special in 2002, at which time the legislature, in its wise wisdom, tried to divert $14 million twice, and Governor Kitzhaber vetoed it twice. And then I guess the third time was a charm. This body, chose to pass a diversion of $9 million, and Governor Kitzhaber at the time let it go through. We did have a $9 million diversion that was directed to Owen that did not go through. And then Senate Bill 581 diverted $3.6 million out of the equipment subaccount down to the state's general fund. And in addition, at that time, you are currently diverting this tax. You have made it a policy decision to take the interest earnings off of this account and divert it to the state's general fund. We believe that is wrong. We believe that all of the money that the carriers graciously collect, you are asking private businesses to collect these funds and turn it over to the state, and then you are diverting their customers' money into the state general fund. It is wrong. We urge you to stop doing it. Mr. Honeyman is absolutely correct that we are losing out on federal dollars that we could get. The Net 911 Improvement Act actually has language in it, and it was a federal choice to incent states to not take 911 dollars. So if you divert, you're not eligible for these FCC E-911 grant program. They just simply will not give it to you, and we are on that list, and it is because the federal government doesn't want us to divert funds and then backfill us with some federal grants out of their pocket. So we urge you to support this bill. We urge you to send it to Ways and Means, where it has been assigned a subsequent referral by the presiding officer. We hope that the Ways and Means Committee will support the bill. I am not, this isn't my first rodeo on this. It would be a nice gesture if you could at least just re-divert the interest earnings back into the emergency communications account instead of putting it in the general fund.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair? No. Senator Olson?
Yes. Ms. Squires, would we require a bill to eliminate that diversion of interest, or can we amend this bill?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, it is a budgetary function. And that is a function of the Ways and Means process that diverts that. So you could do it without a bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Art Butler, Daryl Fuller, or excuse me, Daryl, you had a comment on 598.
Yep.
Correct? And I'll ask Art Butler to come up and join you, and either Mike or Doug, one of you, actually both of you can come up and find a chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, while they're coming up, Daryl Fuller for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association here in support of Senate Bill 598. I'll make my testimony really brief. I have an iPad sitting in front of me. I can push three buttons and tell you where my son's cell phone is. I can push three buttons and tell you where my daughter's iPad is right now. If somebody from the Capitol calls me, if somebody who works in a state office in Bend calls me, or if somebody who works in a state office in Portland calls me, the caller ID on my phone is exactly the same no matter where in the state you call me from. It's all the exact same Salem number on caller ID. The state and many large businesses are simply behind the times in providing the technology to 911 call centers so that when first responders go into a large business or a large any number of other things, including state offices, we often don't know where to go, and 911 callers often aren't in a position to tell us where they are. So we believe it's an important public policy decision to encourage it or to require businesses to use technology that exists so that when someone does call 911 in distress, that the person answering the 911 call will know where in the building they are and where we need to go. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mike?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Mike Dewey on behalf of the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. Doug Cooley from Comcast decided to go up to filming episode of Grimm as opposed to appearing before this committee. I don't know why, but he did. Comcast is a member of our organization and has sought an amendment. I want to commend Senator Olson on his flexibility and his desire to get a bill moving, and we will get a bill this session in the area of the multi-line philosophy that's in this bill. The cable industry comes late to the telecommunications business, and quite frankly, on the landline side, residential-wise, it's almost kind of a zero-sum game as more and more people ditch their landline and move to cell phones. Younger people are not as impressed with the landline service as some other people like me. So, but the business side is huge because that market continues to grow for all of the competitors, and there's a lot of competition in this arena. And I provide this information to you because this bill in these types of requirements are new to us, and as Mr. Butler had pointed out, our telephone networks, our internet protocol networks, VoIP, and the networks work differently in terms of identification. We, I think, established that in the last two hearings we had. We have some amendments that we think are not significant to the bill, taking the word provides, facilitates, clarifying that these are voice networks we're talking about as opposed to telecommunication networks, because that sometimes gets you into a regulatory structure, and we want to avoid that. We think the definition of multi-line systems may be a little bit too broad and would apply to systems that ought not to apply to. And there was a discussion in March of last year regarding my notes on that. We do think we also have an amendment, and this is, we're working on that, and I know Senator Olson does not want to delay this, and we will get these done. There is a section on the liability and what, how you are liable, how you are liable, and it appears that it would be only for new systems, not old systems. If you comply, but somehow the network didn't work, but everything is configured to do that, and it wasn't willful or wanton. So I will stop there, but we can get these amendments drafted quickly, and I think we can get this bill going. There's a few other questions about some definitions that seem to be out of place, and I just want to work through that in my mind.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Art Butler. I'm with the Aderwin Law Firm, and I'm here representing Tracer, which is an association of large telecommunications users. Tracer members are all owners of multi-line telephone systems. Tracer supports this bill generally, in its imposition of a requirement on owners and operators of multi-line telephone systems, new systems, to identify at least the street address and building name of locations from which emergency calls are made. However, we do have one concern, and that is with the definition of key telephone systems. And I'm sure you've all used telephones where you have a number of buttons on the side or across the bottom. Buttons that are lit up signify the fact that that line is in use. If you want to make a call, you have to push one of the unlit buttons. That's a key system. And it is that use of direct line selection that distinguishes a key system from a PBX or a hybrid. Our concern is that the definition in the current bill of a key system is so broad that it would cover virtually all multi-line telephone systems. And that's a change from the definition that we talked about in the workshops. Our recommendation is that we go back to the definition of a key telephone system that we had and discussed during the workshops. And that is a definition that comes from the National Emergency Numbering Association's model bill. And I have some language which I can provide that would do that. And with that change, Tracer supports this bill. We think that it is practical, it's balanced, and it will address the biggest victim location problem faced by emergency responders. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to respond to them.
The only question I have is, both Mike and Art, you need to get with council yesterday on your amendments. So, and Vice Chair? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, can I just note the irony that the two people from the high-tech telecoms are reading off of scratched newspapers and and handwritten notes, and the guy from the local county sheriff is the guy with the iPad.
And just for the record, I don't own a cell phone anymore. I still have a landline, Mike.
Thank you.
If there's no one else signed up, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 598 and 597 and open a very brief public hearing on SB 813. Madam Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 813 moves the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program from the Office of Emergency Management to the Department of Administrative Services. There is a dash one amendment. It's uploaded on OLIS as well as I believe you have a hard copy in front of you. That replaces the generic or general DAS with the Oregon Business Development Department, the Infrastructure Finance Authority, and the latter would be responsible for administering the grant program. It also adds a representative of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators to the grant committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department. This bill, as well indicated by the staff, does move that program away from the Office of Emergency Management. The background on this program is, you well know, the esteemed Senate President, Senator Peter Courtney, sponsored a series of companion measures in 2005. And under Senate Bill 2 through 5 to provide a statewide seismic risk assessment methodology and direction in order to implement this program. Senate Bill 2 required the Department of Geological and Mineral Resources or Industries to complete a statewide seismic needs assessment. The assessment of school buildings and public safety facilities included a rapid visual screening of such buildings and a ranking of these screenings based on the need and the risk. This assessment was completed in June of 2007. Senate Bill 3 provided OEM with the authority to develop and implement the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program and establish the Grant Committee. Senate Bills 4 and 5 authorize the issuance of Article X1-N and X1-M bonds, which provided the funding mechanism to implement the ballot measure for seismic rehabilitation of schools and emergency services buildings, respectively. Bonds weren't authorized in 2005 or 7. The legislature did approve $30 million bonds, general obligation bonds for seismic rehabilitation under previous articles of the Oregon Constitution during the 2009 legislative session and subsequently reduced to $22.5 million in 2010. An additional $7.5 million in Article M1 bonds was authorized. To put it succinctly and directly, this has been a very successful program. This program has done a world of work for our world of good, particularly in schools. To give you an example, 62% of the total bond receipts have gone to schools, $18.8 million. Beaverton School District 2 projects, Medford School District 2, David Douglas, Rogue River, Lake County, Klamath Falls 1. 38% of the bond proceeds have gone to the emergency services facilities, and that's $11.2 million. City of Coos Bay, City of Dallas, City of Albany, City of Eugene, City of Silverton, City of Astoria. From our standpoint, we think this program is valuable, it's necessary, and the only problem is we don't have enough money to do the real need out there because it's immense. The reason that we went to the governor and asked that this program be removed from our budget was simply because of the way we do business in the Oregon legislature and how we calculate things. In our case, where we had we have a total of, in our agency, we've had numerous bonds, a total of around $9 million, over $9.5 million. $3.2 million of that debt service, that's debt service on bonds, $3.2 million of the debt service is attributed to this program. The legislature has been very willing to put that money in the budget every time the bonds are sold. The problem becomes when we go through the budgeting in the state budget system, as we did this year, and it came out just prior to the legislative session beginning, we were required to come up with 5, 10, and 15% cuts as a potential for our budget. My budget then is inflated by this number of debt service, which has to be paid first. The only place I have to get to replace that money on a 5, 10, and 15 is somewhere else in the budget. In the last session, we eliminated 32 positions. 11 of them were exclusively, or 11 of them had people in them. The others were vacant. We'd kept them vacant, thinking that would be enough, knowing the fiscal uncertainty of that last session. With this inflation, then I end up having to reach down in some cases, reduce people because I only have one place to go. So we asked the governor to remove the thing from our budget because we're currently at our current budget situation, without getting you into the weeds, is we have about $14.4 million to operate the agency, our total of general funds. The total budget is around 24 million, I think it is. Yeah, 24. The rest of that is debt service. In 1993, without any debt service, I had $12.5 million to operate the agency. So we've grown about $1 million in actual money in the agency. The rest of it's been debt service. And again, this is a difficult situation. We think we're running the program very well. The committee's working well. It's a streamlined. It's very efficient. It's, I think, operating perfectly, as Senator Courtney had envisioned. If we had more money to go out, and we don't dislike this program at all, we think it's a great program. It's just a simple budget issue for us. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the Director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority. I think probably the first question you have is, what is the Infrastructure Finance Authority? And let me just briefly describe it. The legislature created the Infrastructure Finance Authority in the 2009 session. At that time, there was a great deal of confusion within the former Economic and Community Development Department about what are the business functions of that department and what are the essentially community development functions of that department. That was straightened out through your actions to create the current Business Development Department with a side that deals with businesses and the programs associated with that. And the community development programs are a division of that department, and that's what deals with the community development and infrastructure functions in the state. Just to give you a little bit of background of what our activity currently entails, we have 6 infrastructure programs. 2 of those are federal, 4 of those are state revolving loan funds. They deal with water, wastewater systems, emergency buildings, public buildings, industrial lands, infrastructure that makes communities function. Certainly the buildings described and the targets of the seismic rehab program are part of that local function of what makes communities work and do they operate effectively. We are connected to the communities through cities, counties, or special districts through the regional staff persons we have. We have a strong connection. We have people identified with geographic regions throughout the state. In fiscal year 2012, we did 73 projects around the state, committing $65 million biannually. We do just about double that. We expect to be on that same path for this biennium. I will point out that the Dash 1 amendments eliminate some possible problems that could have been created by transferring this program just to the department. I have an Infrastructure Finance Authority board. This particular program has its own advisory committee that is charged in statute to make the decisions on the funding. And through the Dash 1 amendments, we have made sure that we don't have 2 bodies looking at this program and approving the projects. So I think we've laid the right groundwork to operate the program. I thoroughly agree with General Caldwell that the program has been a great success so far. We're prepared to pick it up and continue that success if that's the desire of the legislature.
We're going to put it on the calendar next week, so it is.
Mr. Chairman, I just add one other thing. I just noticed in the bill that the effective date is January 1, 14. The governor's proposed budget, our budget right now that's in, has it happening at this session, so I'd recommend if you move the bill to change that to an emergency clause so it coincides with what the governor's proposed budget says right now.
The amendment has emergency clause in it.
Good.
Okay. There'll be a Dash 2 amendment next week. Any other? Madam Vice Chair?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Mr. Courtney? Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, let me add that the governor's budget does have $30 million to recapitalize this program, 15 going to the health and safety buildings, as well as $15 million to schools.
We appreciate that. And with that, the public hearing is closed. There's no more business to the committee today. Hearing over for the day. Thank you. Okay, we need a Dash 2 amendment to change.